Hello, my name is Gemma Lawrence and I am the Culture Shift producer for Creative Carbon Scotland. Welcome to the second in our series of podcasts, which we are producing as part of our Green Teas event series and network. In our most recent Green Teas, which took place on Saturday the 30th of March at the Centre for Contemporary Art in Glasgow, we hosted an event titled Biosystems, Cli-Fi, the New Weird, run by A&E Collective, which will be introduced further on in this podcast. This Green Teas was supported through our Open Call, which provides funding and event running support to put on events which connect the worlds of arts and environmental sustainability across Scotland. This Open Call was run in collaboration with Unfix Festival of Art and Ecology, and from a range of applications, A&E Collective were selected to run this event. Annie Lopez from A&E Collective kicks off this episode.
Thank you for Creative Carbon Scotland for allowing us to be here. Like, we feel so lucky to be here, kind of nervous actually, because it's something that we always wanted since last year, and this is like really big for us. So thank you so much for joining us in this. This is a very special edition of Biosystems, which is going to explore the role of climate fiction in allowing us to retune with the environment that is around us. So you know who I am, my name is Anne, and together with, they are all spread around the room, but I'm going to try to point at them. Finn, there he is, Hayden, Lucy, who's at the back, Maria in the fiery hair, and and Marie over there. So our focus is to explore the pains, the pleasures, the potentials and the problems of the ecologically fraught era we live in. And I'm going to just very briefly explain you how this afternoon is going to work. So we first can screen our film From Mole to Mars. Then we're going to move into exploring the dimensions and possibilities of climate fiction together with Ollie and Riz, who are our guests, and that we're soon going to introduce properly. And then on the second half, we're going to immerse ourselves into the zone. And then that will allow us to kind of share our experiences into the ideas of escapism and hope. So I'm now going to introduce you to From Mole to Mars, which is a film that we have worked with in collaboration with Winnie, who's also kind of hiding there. And it wouldn't actually be impossible without her, and she's been kind of like the, almost like the brain and the eye of this film. So we're really thankful for her to do the camera work for us. And the film, we believe, it talks for itself. So we're just going to let you watch it and then we'll be back after that. Okay.
A&E described the film as drawing on new materialist philosophies and the eerie aesthetics of novels like Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation. It challenges what presence means in the context of an unknown world within our world, which they call the Zone, after Tarkovsky's Stalker. Watching the film, we were transported to an unfamiliar and familiar landscape of the Isle of Mull, seen through a lens of microscopic imagery and ecological features of the island from the land and sea. The film is being submitted to some festivals, so we wish A&E all the best in its future screenings. After the film, Dr. Rhys Williams, Lord Kelvin Adam Smith Research Fellow in Fantasy Literature from the University of Glasgow, gave a presentation on the history of climate fiction, or also known as cli-fi, and the new weird, and the challenges that these genres pose to familiar understandings of nature. Slides from Rhys's presentation will be available on the Creative Carbon Scotland website.
Yeah, so my job is the non-creative part of the day. So what is cli-fi, I suppose, would be a good place to start. For those of you who already know this stuff, bear with me. Cli-fi is climate fiction, obviously, right? And it takes its name from a kind of correlation with science fiction or sci-fi. And it's literature that deals with climate change and with global warming. And it's very much in vogue now for obvious reasons, because the climate and nature have kind of forced their way back into our consciousness, into the forefront of our need to understand and explain the world through telling stories. Now, for a long time, nature was in the background in our literatures and in our stories, and this wasn't always the case. With older romances, cool, thank you. In older romances like myths and epics, the natural world played a key part. So storms that pushed Odysseus off course, for example, or the biblical floods, these extravagant or odd or extreme weather conditions would often play key parts in stories. But that started to stop, oddly, at precisely the same time that we started to gain the ability to affect nature and climate. So the kind of literature that started to dominate, and this is literature with a big L, the kind of literature that started to dominate in the West around about the time of the Industrial Revolution, this kind of realism, as we've come to know it, of various types. In that literature, nature gets pushed to the background. And it's a kind of a stage, really, for our human dramas, which are the most important thing to us at the time. And instead of an active agent in our stories, literature becomes this, as I say, backdrop to the things that we do and the things that we sort of care about. And this way of seeing nature stems from... Oh, again, sorry, I was one slow there. This is nature as a backdrop, and again, and again. Thank you. This way of seeing nature stems ultimately back to the Enlightenment. So during the Enlightenment, we begin the kind of grand scientific project of mastery over nature. And this is basically a time where we begin to see everything except for ourselves as objects, objects for study. And as much as it brings us great advances, the interesting thing about seeing nature as an object is that it kind of kills it. It makes it a material that's inert and there to be studied, but not one that really has its own agency, one that has its own potential for action. Thanks. Now, thanks to the enormous growth of the human species over the last 200 years, and this growth was driven in large part by two key industrial revolutions, the Industrial Revolution and the Agricultural Revolution, both of which were fueled by fossil fuels, coal and oil particularly. Thanks to that, we're now capable of having a massive effect on the environment, on the climate, and on nature. We've become actors on a geological scale, essentially. The things that we do affect the entirety of our biosystem. You've all probably seen this graph before, and this is us at the very end making a huge kind of spike in carbon emissions. So the nature that we took for granted all this time, precisely at the time when we were changing it radically, has now kind of forced itself back into the story through its kind of taking on of an agency of its own again, through changing and forcing us to recognize that it's changing. So at this point, we have the growth of Cli-Fi, which rather grandly sees itself as writing to save the world, if that is possible. Typically, Cli-Fi is science fiction or speculative fiction. It posits futures which are near at hand or very far in advance. And essentially, what it does is warn us of the consequences of what we're doing in the present. So by positing these kind of apocalyptic futures where, you know, seas rise and death occurs on mass kind of scales, what we have is an ability to then understand our present as the origin moment of these futures, right? So it creates a kind of past of our present, as it were. And it, by doing that, it brings home to us in this present moment that we are just kind of one moment in this longer story. It frames this moment as a moment in which we could act, and if we don't act, these dire warnings serve to show us what might happen or what will happen. Now, interestingly, the reception of Cli-Fi is not as positive as you might think, particularly for something which is claiming to be, you know, writing to save the world. It's not really doing as good a job as we might hope that it does. There's been some studies on the kind of reception of Cli-Fi, and a lot of the things that come out of these studies are, would be what you would imagine to be. So the readership is mostly younger, mostly already liberal-leaning, mostly already care about the environment. Cli-Fi tends to reinforce already held beliefs, essentially. And it's not actually very good at convincing people that don't already believe in climate change or in, you know, our effect on nature on a grand scale. People who don't already believe in climate change take the fictionality of Cli-Fi as proof of their beliefs, right? This is so ludicrous, so extreme, so fictional that it can't possibly be true. Whereas obviously the people who already believe in it see it as helping them to visualize these kind of concrete visions of the dire futures that we're producing, which is what it hopes to do, right? But it's interesting that it can't cross the divide. It's not perhaps as useful as it hopes to be. Another thing about science fiction is that, about cli-fi, sorry, is that it can produce a desire to do something about the situation. But again, the evidence here is that this desire can only really manifest into actions which you understand is already available to you. Okay, so I'll explain that a little bit more. So it produces, firstly, intensely negative emotions, typically. Shame, guilt, sadness. And there's a question to be asked here, which is, to what extent are those useful emotions if you're trying to mobilize people to act, right? Perhaps we need a little bit more joy, a little bit more excitement in our kind of activism and so on. The other thing that it does, I'll just take a drink. Not mine. But thanks for that. So one thing that it can't do is give us any real sense of what to do beyond the things that we already know that we can do. Okay, so this is another issue with cli-fi. So it can produce a desire to do something, but the evidence here is that unless you already have a kind of program of action, it won't actually give you any more ideas of what to do. So you end up reading lots of cli-fi, feeling terrible about the environment, and then cutting down on plastic straws as a kind of, you know, trying to do something. And I'm certainly not mocking this at all. The point here is that production of desire to do something does not actually necessarily also produce an understanding of what to do. They're kind of two separate things. So the film that we just watched, Mars to Mull, and the book / film Annihilation, how many people have read or seen that? Okay, a few people, fine. So they approach the problem in a very different fashion, a much more radical fashion. And by radical here, I mean from the root, okay? Radical means all the way down, the foundation of things. So they approach the climate crisis not from the kind of pragmatic perspective of these are the results of our actions, what can we do, what kind of policy changes can we have, and so on. But instead, they allow us to, or they try to allow us to engage with this newly weird object, which is nature resurgent, nature with agency, nature that is suddenly alien to us precisely because it's doing stuff. And we didn't think that it really did anything apart from just sit there and look pretty and reproduce itself endlessly. So it teases and kind of plays with these boundaries between us and them, on the one hand exposing how weird nature is, and on the other hand exposing how we are actually quite weird as well. And I'm using weird here as like a technical term, and it's odd because it's also weird in the kind of common and garden sense of weird, but it's weird with a capital W, okay? That's the genre. Now, the grandfather of the weird, as some of you might know, is H.P. Lovecraft, a very problematic author, for those of you who know him. He was writing in the early 20th century, and he wrote lots and lots of short stories, all of which had more or less the equivalent plot. So the equivalent plot was there would be a rational man, it was always a man, and the rational man would be a professor or a lawyer or a doctor, and he would slowly discover a series of clues that would lead him to confront this suddenly, kind of this eruption of this unimaginable, undescribable horror. And the way that Lovecraft would describe this unimaginable, undescribable horror would be through these kind of paradoxical, conflicting, contradictory descriptions. Lots of tumbling adjectives that build and build and build a picture that completely fails to come together. So the idea of the weird, the thing which is weird, is precisely something that we can't grasp, something that we can't categorize, something that we don't understand. You might be able to see already how this kind of story structure is a useful one in the present for thinking through climate change, for thinking through the effects and the consequences of our actions. I've got a couple of examples. This is just from one Lovecraft story. The Call of Cthulhu is the most famous one. Some of you might have read it. The geometry of the place was all wrong. One could not be sure that the sea and the ground were horizontal, hence the relative position of everything else seemed phantasmally variable. Some people think that Lovecraft is a terrible author. Others think that the way that he writes is very much, you know, the reason that his words have the effect that they have is because he writes in this very kind of lush purple way. So it's your choice really whether you like it or not. Everyone watched the queer recession of the monstrously carven portal in this fantasy of prismatic distortion. It moved anomalously in a diagonal way so that all the rules of matter and perspective seemed upset. And then the last one is Cthulhu itself. The thing cannot be described. There's no language for such abysms of shrieking and immemorial lunacy, such eldritch contradictions of all matter, force, and cosmic order, a mountain walked or stumbled. And for those of you who don't like Lovecraft, I'd just point to that last line, which is genius, frankly. A mountain walked or stumbled. That's very strange. Okay, so. So Lovecraft uses this technique to get across the unimaginable quality of something that doesn't fit with what we know, that can't be categorized. And the revelation of this horror in the stories shatters the protagonist's understanding of the world, shatters his sanity, his reason, everything, okay? And the effect here, the aim of the weird, the aim of Lovecraft, was to demonstrate that we parcel up the world and we tell ourselves these comforting stories that we understand it, but then actually, in its revelation to us, we realize we don't understand it at all. And furthermore, and more importantly, we are not masters of it. So the basic message is the world is not what you thought it was, and the world is very much not under your control. If we jump forward to the present day, this technique of weird literature has proven very effective at communicating this idea that we call nature. So for so long, we took it for granted, sat there as a background, but actually it's much more strange, much more complex, and much more alive in the sense of having agency of its own than we thought. So the book Annihilation, the movie of the book, the film you just watched, these are all kind of considered examples of the new weird, or they might be. One last point. A key technique of the new weird is to set up a zone. And the idea of the zone is that it's a bounded space in which the rules are changed. So you enter into it, there is a passage into it, and you'll be doing something similar in a bit, hopefully. And it has this kind of long and prestigious history from Tarkovsky's Stalker, if anyone's seen that, and the book that it was based on, Stragatsky Brothers' Roadside Picnic. But the difference is with today, of course, that the zone is the entire planet. We are already inside the zone. The passage is a kind of narrative, a useful narrative trope, but there is no passage for us. We already exist in this place. So the weird, with its odd images, its unsettling music, its smashing together of unlikely combinations, its constant inability to be able to describe what we see, its deep attention to the microscopic, to the cosmic, to the rhythms and pulses of the life, it all aims to give us a sense of nature that we never knew, a nature that was never safe, a nature that was never just a stable backdrop for our human dramas. And because we're completely entangled with it and we rely on it, this new state of affairs is menacing to us. It's as if nature is rising up and is powerful beyond imagining and is far beyond our control and is threatening us in much the same way that Lovecraft's monstrosities threatened us. Because interestingly, Lovecraft's monstrosities didn't care about us one way or the other. And that's the key here, right? Nature doesn't care about us. People often say that the planet is dying. The planet is fine. We're the ones that might die. Now, obviously, there's no policy recommendations. There's no clue as to get a renewable energy system going. There's no idea how to lobby Theresa May to do anything about all of this. But what there is finally, and usefully, I think, is a deep humility. And maybe that's the most useful thing to take from the new weird. We're not masters of the universe. We're not in control. With the weird, humanity is dethroned. And maybe in the debate around how to respond to the crisis, when the question of planet-scale geoengineering is raised, for example, when we decide we don't need to consider changing our ways because we can instead exert control over the planet again, maybe a little humility would go a long way.
Glasgow-based science fiction novelist and poet Oliver Langmead then performed extracts from his recent publication and gave an overview of the environmental themes within them, including terraforming and post-humanism. Oliver's slides are also available on our site.
Hello. Do we have my... Oh, we do. We have my wonderful slides up. Okay, script. I thought I'd follow on from Rhys's presentation on theory with a presentation on creative practice and take you on a whirlwind tour, it really will be a whirlwind tour, of some of the ways that my writing as an author touches on climate and ecology and humanity's relationship with them through speculative fiction and world building. I have two books published. The first one called Dark Star, which we have an example of here, and Metronome. And I'm currently working on two more called Birds of Paradise and Calypso. And I'm delighted today to be able to introduce you to the worlds contained in each of them, and even perform a little from each of them in turn. In this way, I'm hoping to kindle your imaginations a little more after the movie earlier, before we get into the second part of the workshop, where we're going to be guiding you through exploring strange speculative places of your own. So this is my first book. It's called Dark Star, and it's a noir crime story set on a world that orbits a dark sun. Imagine a city where light is so scarce that it's the currency and the drug and the religion. This guy, for instance, is called Foss, and he is the local deity, a god with the face of a star. In Darkstar, I had to consider what the local sun's lack of visible light would mean for the ecology of the planet, and this manifested itself in a lot of interesting ways, particularly in the mammalian wildlife. I'm going to read you a short extract featuring Inspector York and his partner Dante as they drive out through the permanently dark city of Vox in search of a lead and run into something unexpected. I wind the window down and suck in air like I'm thirsty for it. Watch passing cars and try to blink away the noisy blood thundering in my ears, deafening me. When was the last time you ate anything, York? I don't reply. Try to listen to Vox, but I can't hear over the car's engine, over my own blood beating at my skin. It feels like my blood's trying to break free, trying to shake its way out of my veins, like my bones belong to someone else, like they're all at odd angles and weird shapes. The car suddenly screeches to a halt, throwing me forwards into the dashboard, slamming my forehead against the metal. Feels like my skull cracks from the impact. Shit! Dante curses only once, sharply, then is silent. He's staring at something. What the fuck, Dante? I groan, hold my head. He hisses, shut up, look, just fucking look. Even though my head feels like it's on fire, my forehead like I've been hit with a brick, I take a glance out the front windscreen, then have to do a double take. Looks like the road is white and flowing. Except it's not, it can't be. I focus, try to make out what it is moving out there, and gradually it starts to make some sense. Rats, thousands of them by the looks of it. A multitude of squirming white bodies running and crawling in one long river of vermin across the road before us. Dante cuts the car and I realize that the noise I imagined was my blood is really the rats. They are a hellish choir, crying out to one another, screeching. What in the name of Foss? Dante mutters. We watch them until they finally clear, the last of them vanishing in the dark, out of the car's single headlight, out of our sight. Dante turns to me. What the fuck was that? I don't know what to tell him. Just some rats, an apparition, some kind of white plague. I've never seen, known anything like it. Shit, he says, and he sounds shaken, rattled, which is a rare thing in Dante. He starts the car up again and drives on, shuddering slightly like he's feeling cold. I wonder what it's like to be born blind, like rats are, evolved to live without light. They live out their whole lives on smell alone, on touch, taste, sound. They don't need sight to live. I guess maybe the rats are better off living blind, not knowing what light is like. The blind seem to thrive in Vox. They live well, unencumbered by our communal greed. Okay, next slide, please. So that was a bit of Dark Star. Again, a very whirlwind tour as we move on to my second book. This is Metronome. After the bleak kind of darkness of Dark Star, I wanted to write something bright and vivid. So I wrote an Odyssey Through Dreams. It follows William Mandalay, an elderly violinist, as he follows a map made of music to the very heart of dreaming, where it is said wishes are granted. Of course, along the way, Mandalay is hunted by nightmares, one of which is here. This is an illustration of Slint, the nightmare diver. who is essentially a diving suit filled up with an oily liquid darkness and anxiety about petroculture, maybe. Metronome really tested the limits of my imagination because it contains so many unique small worlds, small dreams. And today I'm going to read to you one of those dreams, which I thought would be relevant. A vision of London after all human life has abandoned it, leaving it to be reclaimed by non-human things. It is becoming increasingly difficult to remember that I am really an old man, fast asleep in my armchair at home. I stand solitary here, more awed by the sight before me than anything I've seen so far in dreaming. I've stepped into a ruined and flooded London. It looks as if the earth has broken open in the wake of an earthquake, shattering the city. There are the shapes of familiar buildings balancing at angles on shards of earth that rise from the high waters. Everything is coated in a layer of life. I've emerged from a door facing London's twin railway stations. From here, the roof of St. Pancras looks like a gargantuan set of ribs, every window smashed, with lengths of vine draped between each curve. And King's Cross looks like an empty birdcage, its thick net of a roof stained so dark it looks as if it's made of wood. As I wander forward, I see lily pads among crisp packets and plastic bottles. And in a way, it's reminiscent of the London I knew as a young man. Wealth and filth, violence and romance, crowds and loneliness. And I am struck by a strong memory of Lily. She would come to every one of my performances with the London Philharmonic that she could. And I would see her in the audience. I remember Lily in winter, wrapped up warmly and wearing a little tinsel in her hair. I remember Lily in spring, wearing such bright colors that she already seemed ready for the warm months to come. I remember Lily in summer, confident enough to bare her collarbones and wrists, and that sly slip of a smile that always seemed to bloom in June. And I remember Lily in autumn, wearing the knitted cardigans she made herself. And later on, in the darkness of my small apartment, she would trace the sounds she heard me play across my chest with the tips of her fingers. So that's Metronome. Next slide, please. Now we're moving on to my current work, which is the stuff I'm doing at the University of Glasgow, or at least inspired by it, like Birds of Paradise is. This is all sort of interwoven with my research into ecological philosophy and the such. This is a book I've been working on for the past couple of years, since 2016, a year which made me very, very angry. It's called Birds of Paradise, and I thought I'd briefly mention it today because I've been writing it as a reaction to climate change. This is where I've been putting all my anger. Birds of Paradise is about what Adam of Eden would be like if he was still alive today. The book is post-utopian in that it's an exploration of how Adam sees the world of today after having lived in a true kind of pastoral paradise thousands of years ago. And while it does have a big, fun plot filled with grand heists, I thought I'd read you one of my favorite sections from the first chapter, just very quickly, where Adam confronts what our world is doing to his memories of paradise. Recently, Adam's been thinking about Eden a lot. The problem he's been having is that he's not sure which bits of his memories are real. He distinctly remembers waking up early one day and walking through the fields of long grasses, the way the grasses cut little red lines across his palms, and the way the waters of the lake at the base of the hills sparkled as if all of Eden's stars had been poured into it. But when he remembers that morning, it feels as if he's wearing shoes. It's not a case of being unable to recall the feel of the grasses beneath his feet, which he knows he should remember. More that there is something faulty with his memory. He's grown so used to the feeling of wearing shoes that his recollections have been corrupted. Adam knows that he never wore shoes in paradise, but still he remembers wearing them. And then one last slide, real whirlwind tour. we get to what I'm working on now. It's okay, you don't need to be able to read that. I will read it to you shortly. This is actually my doctoral project at the University of Glasgow, which is an experimental book-length poem called Calypso. And Calypso, Rhys mentioned geoengineering. Calypso is about terraforming, which, for those who don't know, means that it's a story about transforming a barren planet into one capable of supporting human life. As I said, Calypso is quite experimental compared to the rest of my writing, in that each principal character, of which there are three, has their own form of verse. For instance, Catherine's verse is concrete, and it takes the shape of a waveform. Catherine is interesting to write because she's post-human, which in the context of this poem means that she's been biologically augmented to think faster, live longer, and be in every way superior to us ordinary humans, which is very interesting to try and write. In Catherine's case, she has been augmented for a singular purpose, which is why I thought I'd bring her here today. She has been augmented so that she can transform into a garden. Chapter 4, which is where we're at, follows her transformation from woman to garden. And here I'm going to read you a bit of the start of that chapter, where she talks about her augmentations and the way she relates to them. Think of a child born too small, its tiny heart trembling, skin so thin its veins are visible, a red wrinkled thing helpless and dying, needled and cocooned, we were saved, augmented, our fluttering moth-wing heart given blue whale strength so that our blood became ocean blood, washing waves through us. When we grew up, we felt the moon's tidal tug in our veins. We waxed and waned with dear Luna's seasons, our ocean blood dually pulled by her orbit, influenced by her silver glow, our hearts still remembering its moth-wing flutter. Our marrow was made sap, a sickly gold syrup giving our bones bowel strength so that no part of us might ever be snapped. Our knuckles and knees were the knots of trees, and we would so often stand with our feet buried in the soft earth, spreading our toes like burrowing roots, wrists bared up to the sun. We felt the earth's seasons run deep through our sap marrow, every winter hibernating, lulled always by the frosty chill, and every spring blushing the colors of blossom. Each year adding a ring to our bow bones, increasing our wood forest fortitude, until we became not a tree, but a grove entire. Our eyes were enhanced to falconic sharpness, and augmented further still. Inspired by the senses of migrating birds, we too can feel magnetic fields. They emerge in sight as strict silvery threads netted across the domed whirl of the sky, and they tingle the tips of our fingers should we close our proximity, as if we too might know them through our feathers while in flight. We also see some radiations, a shimmering misty haze, and ultraviolet light making the faces of flowers neon and the wings of insects deliciously bright. We would gaze often at beetle shells, their refractive carapaces and endless delight. I, us, we, the chimera, a child born sickly and in every way improved. Year by year enhanced ever further, breaking every boundary in bioengineering, eradicating all our raw inherited human weaknesses to become this, us, something not human but better than human, a person or persons and an ocean and a forest and all the birds in the sky, engineered to a final brilliant purpose, this, now, our transcendence, we will burst and become truly plural at last, our multiple selves unraveling and catalyzing not a child, but a whole world. Through ribbon arcs of magnetic fields we descend, our ocean blood gushing, our sap marrow hot, all our senses indulged by the sky and the new world's moons which tug at us as we fall. Thank you.
A&E member Maria Sledmere then joined Rhys and Ollie to deliver an original visualization script designed to help workshop participants enter the zone through a short meditation.
Find yourself a comfortable position. Imagine a thin strand of silk is pulling your spine up to a point in the ceiling. Let your feet rest into the floor. You are here in the room. You are going going to drift. Let your attention center on this moment. Listen to the sounds around you, your own breath, and the breathing of others. Follow this rhythm. You are going to drift outwards to the island. On the island, you look for the zone. You are drifting across quantities of swirling water. The wind carries you light through space and time. On this journey, you are looking for a lost world, a world unknown, a world that is only just becoming, a world that moves into a possible future.
Following the meditation, participants were asked to respond with writing or drawing, which was then discussed in small groups with the help of prompts provided by a special edition Biosystems pamphlet. Questions asked of the groups included, were you human, or did you adopt a non-human form at any point when you were in the zone? And what is the value of slow forms of attention in the context of ecological crisis?
Okay, that comes back to a definition of noticing.
Okay.
So we're like, noticing, that seems very passive.
Yeah.
And we're like, maybe that's the wrong word. Like, aren't we supposed to be doing more? But, so then we went on to like, what is noticing and how it can help? And then we went on to how sunflowers can like notice the world and like continually react when the sun passes over. And they're like continually noticing.
Yeah.
And I think for me that's a good definition of noticing, because you have to like always be aware of what's going on. And then we said that cats also like the sun. And chickens also like the sun.
Individual groups then fed back their discussion to the room as a whole. And we were delighted to encounter such a rich array of responses, both verbal, written and visual, touching on ecological ethics, emotional reactions, empathy and storytelling, and the difference between reality and fiction, dreams and film. A&E are now collating some of these responses and intend to assemble a publication from the session as a companion to the film. Watch this space. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of our Green Teas podcast. A quick reminder that our Green Teas open call is open to anyone to apply to, and you can find it on our website. So take a look, and if you're interested in holding an event, then come and talk to us. And I think that's all from us for now. Cheerio!